This is the Future of HR Podcast, episode 118.
Very, very early on, I learned that there was a triangle of HR. And the first one is be a technical expert. Know benefit and comps, know how to do OD, right? Know how to do labor relations, right? All of those disciplines that live within HR. Then be a business partner. So what are the objectives? What are the goals? What are the strategies of the organization? And make sure that everything you're doing, that you're bringing your expertise in service of that. And then lastly, be a change agent. So be a force for good. And in that, be an advocate for the employees so they don't get lost in that equation. But all three of those things have to work in synchrony. And if you ever find that your agenda, that your technical expertise is driving all of your decisions, then you have failed at that triangle. Then you're starting to lean on one leg of that stool more than the others, and it becomes out of balance.
How can you balance the three roles of being an HR leader? What does it mean to be a servant HR leader? Hi, I'm your host, JP Elliott, and this is the Future of HR Podcast, the only podcast whose mission is to inspire the next generation of HR leaders. On each episode, I interview successful HR executives and thought leaders who are reimagining, rethinking, and leading our field into the future. During our candid conversations, you will learn about their career journeys, their lessons learned along the way, and their insights on how to take our field, and most importantly, your career, to the next level. Since I've doubled down on my mission to develop the next generation of HR leaders, I've been asked to be a keynote speaker for 7 different internal HR conferences or career weeks of Fortune 500 companies. This has been a big honor and a blast. What am I speaking on? Well, I'm leveraging my 100-plus interviews on the podcast and my 20-plus year career as a talent and HR executive to talk about 3 things. 1, how HR leaders can have more influence and impact in what I call the influence equation. 2, how to future-proof your HR career in the age of AI. And 3, the future trends impacting our field. I love speaking to HR teams, and I'm extremely grateful for the opportunities that I've had to date. If you're looking for a speaker for your 2025 HR conferences, career weeks, or other meetings, I'd love to hear from you and talk. And with that, my guest this week is Angela Chang Simony. Angela's a global HR executive with over 30 years of experience, partnering with C-suite leaders to drive change and deliver business results. Most recently, Angela was the SVP Talent and CHRO at Harvard Business Publishing. And prior to Harvard Business Publishing, Angela had senior level roles at ClearMotion and Crabtree and Evelyn. In her spare time, Angela serves on several boards and is a sought after speaker and voice in the HR community. In fact, Angela was a speaker at Elevate by Future of HR this year and got amazing feedback. I really enjoyed my conversation with Angela, and I know you will too, as we discussed how Angela transformed an experience early in her career into a lifelong leadership lesson, why she believes the best HR leaders are technical experts, business-focused, and change agents, her vision for hyper-personalization and employee experiences and how HR can practically implement this, and why she is passionate about paying it forward and helping others and their careers. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this episode as you listen, so drop me a line on LinkedIn or say hello. And now let's jump into my conversation with Angela. Angela, welcome to the Future of HR Podcast. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you, JP?
Oh, I'm so good. It's great to have you on the podcast and great to spend some time with you today. I want to start and talk a little bit more about your career. And thinking back to your earlier career, you've had one or two experiences that just have really made a big impact on you. We'd like to know a little bit more about what those experiences were and what the impact was.
I think one of the most formative experiences I had was being completely ripped to shreds by an executive in sales. And I was green, newbie, first job out of school. I had an aha moment that I could either lie down and take it, or I could advocate for myself. The tender age of 22, I kind of said, screw it. It's ride or die here. And I basically said to the guy who had a reputation for being a bully, said, look, there's only one person who can sort of dress me down that way, and it's my dad. you're not my dad. So I'm going to pack up my things and go back to my office. And if you would prefer that I not come back, I'll just wait for that call. And I immediately called my VP of HR, who, even though he was two clicks above me, three clicks above me, he was serving as my sponsor mentor. And I said, hey, I just had this run in. Just wanted to let you know. And he's like, okay, I'll let you know. And later that afternoon, I got an apology call. And I never, ever forgot that lesson. I don't think it changed that guy, but it changed him for me, because I never had that kind of conversation with him ever again. And it proved to me that I have a responsibility to myself to advocate for what I need, and that as a leader in HR, I need to do that for other people and help to create an environment in organizations where people, A, don't experience that, but B, that they do have a place where they can go, where they can get help and support.
That's an incredible, incredible story. And just the being that brave at 22 to push back, it's not easy. You know,
I mean, it was a very scary moment, but I was literally looking at the precipice. You know what's scarier, JP, is when you're driving home and you replay that conversation, you say, I should have done this and I should have, and you're beating yourself up the whole way home because you failed yourself. And in that moment, I wasn't going to do that.
Well, I love that. And I think, you know, it goes to your leadership style, but it's a great lesson about self-respect, right? And saying, look, you know, I may have made some mistakes. You may not be happy with the work, but I'm not going to take you yelling at me like my mom or dad might yell at me. Probably moms and dads shouldn't also yell at their children in that way. That's a whole other podcast. But I love the fact that you said that respectfully, like, hey, I'm not going to take that. And if I'm not going to work here, then that's fine. I mean, you threw the gauntlet down. So that's amazing. And I think a lot of people honestly would have not been sure how to handle it. But your story maybe will help prepare some people if they have that situation. And you're so true that as HR leaders, we have to be able to speak truth to power, stand up for people, stand up for ourselves at times, even if it's uncomfortable. So thank you for doing that. That's a great story. You've also said that you prefer to work in smaller organizations. And I know sometimes in the CHRO game, that is the goal, to be at bigger, larger organizations. Other CHROs have different goals. And it sounds like for you, you really enjoy that smaller, more intimate feel of a company. Tell us more about that.
I do. It's twofold. One is I enjoy having the one-on-one impact. You know, what's most gratifying, what keeps me energized about this work is when I can help an employee solve a problem, take on a different perspective, think through something that they're struggling with, so that they can go home and be like, you know what, I work at a pretty cool place. And I can come back the next day and go back at it. That's really, really gratifying, right? That one-on-one. And you lose that. You can't possibly scale that kind of interaction when you're working at an organization with 100,000 people. The other thing that I like about working at an SMB is the variety of the work. There are never enough hands on deck. And that's probably true even for the multi-billion dollar multinationals. But even more so in smaller organizations, right? You just have to be able to be agile enough to pivot and stuff envelopes one day and then fly at 30,000 foot view to think about, you know, what's the 5-year plan. So I really like the variety of the work. It keeps me honest. It keeps me sharp. It never affords me an opportunity to get lazy because there's just too much work and not enough people.
That's so true. It's also, I think, when you're in the smaller organizations, it's a little bit easier to see that direct line of sight from what you did to the impact.
Yes.
Usually it's a quicker time frame to see the impact than it might be in a really big Fortune 100 company.
And I can actually reach out to the organization. I can reach out to Joe or Tom or Carrie and say, hey, what did you think of that? How was that change management experience for you? What was the message that you heard? Because I know what I intended, right? I actually know people who are doing the work to understand whether or not, you know, we're hitting the way we want to be.
That's great. And when you think about next-gen HR leaders, what advantages or advice do you have for them who are working in small organizations? How do they make the most of that opportunity?
Don't be afraid to make a mistake. I'm certainly never been in a position where the mistakes I've made are so bad that someone else can't come in and fix them. It can be absolutely humiliating and distressing, but it's never irrevocable. So I think it's fear that holds us back from trying stuff. And in small organizations, you don't have the sophistication usually to know the answers to everything in particular, right? Even in large organizations, but in particular, So just go out and try it. Build out your network. Read. Listen to podcasts like this one. Follow people that you admire so that you can learn from their mistakes and take from their experiences. But just try and go do stuff. When we're paralyzed by fear, that's when we fail.
That's great advice. Because obviously, you are a small organization. You may have to do some things you've never done before. And
yes.
I think that's okay. And what I hear you saying is, hey, try it. If it doesn't work out, you can switch, you can change, you can adapt. But you're learning and you've got to move a lot of times in small organizations. You don't have time to wait and, you know, get a committee, analyze it. You're like, I've got to make a decision because we need to move forward. So it sounds like that's what you're advocating for.
Actually, I've also learned how to ask for help, even from folks on my own team. So we are taking the organization for the first time ever through a comprehensive workforce strategy where we're going to assess the organization from top to bottom. We're going to focus on data and analytics, but eventually we will get through the entire organization, right? See where our gaps are. What do we build, borrow, buy? And it's an exercise that I've actually never led before, but there's someone on my team who has done it multiple times over. So she's taking the lead on it. And I've been very open that I'm learning and watching her. I have a point of view, but I've gotten to be very comfortable because my team's success is based upon allowing everyone to bring their very best. And if I were to pretend that I know what I'm doing, then we're doomed. So it's in everybody's best interest, right, to let the best player step forward in that moment.
That's a real advantage in small organizations that you get to do that a lot of times. There's more variety of things because there may not be somebody who's got that responsibility. So it becomes your responsibility to learn and implement it.
Yeah.
And in this case, it's great that you're open to, of course, learning from your team and letting them take the lead, which is awesome.
Hey, everyone. After a quick break, we'll be right back to our conversation with Angela. I'm excited to let you know that I've recently put together a succession planning playbook that you can download for free at futureofhr.com. And whether you want to assess your current approach to succession planning or you're building your leadership development strategy from scratch, this playbook offers an actionable framework designed to help you understand what great succession planning looks like. So go to futureofhr.com and download the succession planning playbook today.
Now, Angela, we already learned a little bit about your leadership style by the impressive story as a young 22-year-old who stood up to a bully leader. But you described yourself as really more of a servant leader as your leadership style. And just tell us more about what this means and how do you bring it to life each day?
I think it's fundamentally what HR is. Very, very early on, I learned that there was a triangle of HR. And the first one is be a technical expert. No benefit and comms, know how to do OD, right? Know how to do labor relations, right? All of those disciplines that live within HR. Then be a business partner. So what are the objectives? What are the goals? What are the strategies of the organization? And make sure that everything you're doing, that you're bringing your expertise in service of that. And then lastly, be a change agent. So be a force for good. And in that, be an advocate for the employee so they don't get lost in that equation. But all three of those things have to work in synchrony. And if you ever find that your agenda, that your technical expertise is driving all of your decisions, then you have failed at that triangle. Then you're starting to lean on one leg of that stool more than the others, and it becomes out of balance. And so I've always learned that the business is why we are there, and we are not meant to be just a mouthpiece for the organization. We have a clear responsibility to be an advocate for the right kinds of culture, to live by our values. But it's always in service of making the organization succeed. And as you and I understand really, really well, if employees are in a space where they feel heard and respected, then they will bring their A game, which means the organization will do it. It's a bottoms-up approach to leadership, I think.
I think that's so, it's just so important what you said around the triangle, how people understand that you've got to make sure you're balancing that decision-making. Right. And I think that's a really good message. You've also said that we forget about the basics sometimes in HR and that we're overlooking some of the fundamentals that are really important. And what are some of the fundamentals that you think we need to pay more attention to as HR leaders?
So one of the things that I discovered when I came to Harvard Business Publishing actually was that we needed to go back to basics, that some of the foundational systems and processes and programs either weren't well understood, they weren't well executed, or they had no longer represented the best in class thinking. And so we went back to the ground up and started with what does professional development look like at HUP? And it was a little bit of an irony because obviously we publish at HBR all about this. And so my mission having come here is not only to implement best practices, but now to create those. And so we put in place a career pathing framework that took 9 months and galvanized a third of the organization to help build. But it was to answer the question, how do I see myself growing in this organization? And how can I take my skills and learn new ones or amplify them? Because people were leaving HVP just as I was choosing to join. And there was never before that a really robust career development framework. So we put that in place. And that has become the flywheel for so many other elements of our HR strategy. Through that, we've identified the skills that are needed for success. We've identified what it looks like to be promoted to have intermobility. So that drives our talent acquisition strategy. That drives our L&D strategy. It helps us to understand who's next in line for succession. And those are all things that weren't systems that really had worked cohesively together before. And some were more evolved than others. And now I'd like to think that we brought them all up a step and we're in year two and year three in a lot of those efforts. And we're just going to go back and make sure that they're still working as intended. So before we get all excited about the next Gen A application, fundamentally, do people feel like the organization pays them well, gives them an opportunity to learn, that their manager is taking care of them? If you can't answer those things, then everything is just lipstick on a pig.
I love your perspective on this because my 100 plus interviews now on this podcast, what I hear from the best HR leaders is what I call execution plus, right? It's like, if you don't execute the basics, you can't get to the plus.
That's right.
Yeah. And the plus is what we get real excited about, whether it's Gen AI or yeah. a new skills-based platform or whatever fancy tool you're excited about from a vendor's got you hyped up on. You know, if you're not paying people properly, if they just don't feel like there's a career path, they don't feel like their leaders know how to have conversations, that is going to be a problem. And you've got to address it. And so I think there's always this tension in HR of doing the work that really sets this foundation and trying to do the cool, sexy stuff that we want to do because we sort of feel like the other stuff might be a little bit boring. So I love that you're kind of talking about the foundations.
And that goes back to that triangle. If we are only excited about being a technical expert and doing all the bells and whistles, but we forget about the other pieces of that stool, that's when it falls out of balance. And what I think is really cool about this perspective is that you don't need to have a $1 million budget to do the foundations really well. You can do that on the back of an Excel spreadsheet. That's how the career ladder framework started. In fact, when I show people our work, I still show them that Excel spreadsheet. So you don't need to have a $multi-million HCM system to do these things really well. You just need time and the energy to focus on it.
And it sounds like you involved, what, 2/3 of the organization, which is also great. So people feel like they've got some ownership.
Yes.
Wasn't done in a vacuum, right?
Cool.
And really can be adopted because, again, you know, you can have the best ideas, but if leaders and team members don't adopt that idea, if they don't actually use it, what happened? Is that really worth your time? Like, you've got to make sure people want to use these things that we put into place. Otherwise, it's just a wasted effort.
I mean, to be fair, we got some pushback. People were like, we're doing HR's job. We're building out these career ladders. I'm like, well, okay, I can cut and paste from American Association of Marketers, but this has instant credibility because it's being built by the people who are actually doing the work. People came to recognize that. And yes, it's much more reflective of the skills and the responsibilities they have versus something that I just randomly found on the internet.
Yeah, co-creation is so important. And hopefully you got past the, we're doing HR's job, because you're not really. But HR's job was to bring them together to help build that and get adoption and people excited about it. So that's great. There's also something I know you and I have talked a little bit about this, Angela. There's just almost a leadership crisis lately we've heard about. In a 2024 report from Randstad, 34% of workers don't want to become managers, which is a third, 3 out of 10, many people do not want to become managers, which is a little bit shocking to me because you always think, obviously, I'm pretty highly ambitious and you are as well, but like you don't want to become a manager. I'm curious, like, what are your thoughts on this kind of report? Are you seeing that in what you're seeing and hearing as a CHRO?
Well, I will tell you that my 25-year-old daughter absolutely looks at my job and says, I do not want any part of that. It carries so much stress. You take so much of it home emotionally. That I just sort of want to be able to do my bit, do it really well, and then sign off and go do the other things. A job is merely a means to an end, right? It's not what we live for. So I think it is typically downplay generational differences, and I can talk about that in a minute. I do think that that is something we are seeing more and more of in early career folks. the pandemic fundamentally reprioritized what people found important in their lives. It causes them to question whether or not that's really the American dream for them. It was for us, it was for our parents, because that's what we were told the model was. And everything since then has been upended. So why not question the conventional linear fashion where you go from junior woodchuck to mid-manager woodchuck to senior woodchuck? That's not for everyone. So it doesn't surprise me at all. And when we see the crisis at middle management, where they're player and coach, strategist and executioner, they get crunched in the middle. It's not the most glamorous bit right now.
Yeah, I wonder too. I mean, this has been for a long time. Managers have always had this, you know, this middle role where you obviously high level strategy comes down and they have to now execute that. And then, of course, anyone who's working with them is looking to them for that leadership or player coach. But as we continue to have sometimes downsizing in tech and other organizations, we've leaned out these management ranks.
Yes. You know,
and at one point it was, this is a while back, but maybe if you're a senior director, even a director, you were doing more strategy than you were doing the work. Now, if you're a director, even a VP, you are a player coach. By the way, if this is my tip for anyone interviewing and you're going for higher level roles, please tell them that you are a player coach because they want to hear that.
That's right. Right?
Because we are so lean, we're expecting our VPs to be able to put PowerPoint decks together, to get into Excel and build models, right? And I think we've really done ourselves a disservice. We're not investing enough in our leaders and our managers, enough resources and time, because we always add more things to people's plate, not less. And we don't give them a lot of support and resources. So it's kind of not surprising that some people are like, no, I don't want that. That looks like a lot of work, not fun. And maybe there's different ways to think about my career path. So it's really interesting.
Yeah. And I think you've touched on something else that I've been hearing, doing more with less. And I think that's the wrong proposition. I think we should be thinking about doing less with less. What I mean by that is not being less productive, but really focusing on a few key items that really move the needle so that you can do it with less. It's a fallacy that we can do more with less. That's literally physically impossible. So why do we keep telling our organizations that we're going to do more with less?
Exactly. I agree with you so wholeheartedly on that, because we say that all the time, do more with less, and it's just not fair. It's not real. And honestly, this falls back on leaders. Whether you're an HR leader or another senior leader, we have to prioritize for our team. And we have to prioritize where we'll have the most impact. And I don't think we always do that for our teams. And that's where, to your point of like, if we do less but they're higher impact, then you're doing the right things. But when
that's
we start
right.
to do more, it's not connected. That's where you start putting people to the level of stress, because they're like, why am I doing this one more project? I thought this other thing was important. Now you give me five more things. And of course, that's just working world, but an ideal world for leaders, your job is to prioritize for your team. And
that's right. Provide clarity.
Deliver what matters.
That's right.
Yeah. The other thing we talked about, and I know you're really passionate about this, is you have been really working to create, or believe we should be creating, personalized experiences for employees. Something you called hyper-personalization. Tell us more about your vision for this. It sounds sexy. It sounds like maybe past fundamentals, Angela. So I got to make sure I call you out on this.
That's right.
Tell us more about it.
We haven't quite gotten there yet, but because now I feel really good about our foundation, it is something I'm going to be increasingly turning our attention to. So hyper-personalization for me is, how do we meet employees where they are? So in every other facet of our life, we are now becoming more accustomed to being spoon-fed exactly what we want when we want. And so Amazon knows that my favorite shampoo is about to run out. My printer knows I'm about to run out of cyan ink, and it delivers it to my home before I even know I need it. Netflix tells me what movies I like. Spotify will suggest new artists, because it has all this data about us, right? It's intrusive, but they do, and they spend billions of dollars to mine for that data and then deliver a customer experience that is just for me. So I believe that organizations and employers should be doing exactly the same. Now, we probably don't make the same kind of investment, but we do sit on enough data to be able to tell us that, hey, Sally hasn't been promoted in 5 years. She hasn't gotten a significant bump in her increase beyond the annual merit. And she's worked for 3 managers. That's probably a red flag. Let's have a conversation with Mary about what are her career aspirations. Let's do some benchmarking to make sure that she's paid equitably. And let's talk about what skills and where her interests lie, and then build out a plan. And we need to do that for everybody who works for us. So again, this is not something you need a lot of sophisticated machinery behind, because we're already knowing these things about our employees, but it's now actually turning it into information that we can act on.
Yeah, I love that vision. And I think there's more and more tech coming down the path that'll help us do that. You know,
yes.
I think in a small organization, it might feel like you can be able to figure that out, right? You know, you can look at individuals and say, hey, this is what's going on. And that's what the best HR people are doing. Where I think the scale comes in is the nudges or a way to sort of track, hey, these are people at risks. And I think a lot of organizations are trying to get to predictive analytics.
That's right.
And it's on the way. It mm-hmm. just depends on where you're at. But I do believe this hyper-personalization, I think in general, we all want HRS systems and HR to really operate just like our smartphones operate, right? And so I think that is an expectation that's just raised that employee right. experience so high. Going back to your career pathing model, because I thought it was really fascinating. What advice would you give? You talked about you can start with a spreadsheet, but what advice would you actually give to someone who's like, I want to try to implement something similar? Where do you start on that path?
So the blueprint for us actually was, I convened the executive team and I said, tell me about all the different career families you think we have. And they came back to me with 50. And then my team synthesized that all. And we discovered we're not all that special. We're not all that unique. And we came down to 20. And within those 20, we then brainstormed what were the key skills. Once we identified the key skills, that's when we had the incumbents come participate and build out the actual levels of mastery for each of those, and that put it into the framework. And that was the bulk of the work. That probably took 4 months of work because people were doing that on top of their day jobs. And then we pressure tested that again with an executive sponsor to make sure that the skills and all of that matched up with our goals and our strategies. And then we rolled it out. I guess I make that sound really simplistic, but that was essentially the blueprint for that. And it just took over 9 months. And again, I think any organization can do that. I did it, automotive technology firm with only 120 employees with an HR staff of me plus two other people. Just took us longer, but we still got it done. And it was so important for employees to be able to see us willing to take that kind of effort. So I believe that if we can do it at a startup with 120 people, you can absolutely do it at any other size organization.
It's inspirational. And it sounds like that meeting with your senior team, getting aligned is really critical. How did you get past the, Angela, this sounds like an HR task or, you know, what are we doing? Job families? Like, hey, is that helping? That's not driving revenue or getting us new amazing Harvard business books and publications.
That's a great point, JP. So it was triggered by, I was sitting in on exit interviews. It was at the height of the Great Resignation. And the number one reason why people said they were leaving was because they couldn't see themselves in a new role within 3 to 4 years. I couldn't see a path forward. I'm like, I can solve for that. If you told me you weren't paid enough, that's a lot tougher. But career development, that I can solve for. And so it was a direct line to how do we ensure that we're keeping our best people, that we manage the churn and the turnover, and for the business's sake, that we understand the skills that we have in-house and which ones we don't. It was actually a pretty easy conversation to have once I was able to send the message.
I'm glad you brought that back up because I do think it's so important to tie that back to the business case, right?
Yes.
What is the business problem we're solving? Otherwise, it does feel like just this HR exercise when you're like, wait a minute, why would I spend my time with this? But when you start to say, hey, this is about retention. We're losing people because there's not a career here. Then people start to pay attention, right? Some organizations are going to make you quantify that and tell me, well, how much is the turnover? You know, great. If you have to go that next step, you can. Hopefully, you have an enlightened executive team like you do that says, wait a minute, oh, if this is happening and you think this will solve it, then let's get together and figure out how we create career paths that make sense. That's
exactly.
Awesome. Angela, another thing I really admire about you is you really spend a lot of time paying it forward and paying it back, as you say, and you've had this great fortune in your career to do that. But tell us more about why that's so important to you and some of the work you're doing there.
So coming through the ranks, I didn't see any senior and certainly no executive Asian leaders, even more limited female Asian leaders. And so I felt that once I had reached this height in my career, that I had an obligation to help others see what could be possible. Right? We say that you can't be what you can't see. And so I've become really active in communities that are helping to promote the advancement of the AAPI community. JP, you and I have talked about the staggering statistic that says only 1% of the C-suite is Asian female. And that's particularly astounding given how many Asian females are often represented in lower ranks of organizations. And that's what's driving some of the disconnect. Organizations will look at the percentage of their population that is represented by APIs and they'll say, oh, my number's fine. but it drops off substantially as you move into seniors. I've been paying it forward by helping others to learn what's worked for me and hoping that it might work for them, and giving up my time to coach and give feedback and serving as sponsors for people who aspire to do bigger and better things with their career.
When you think about your career, are there things that have helped you to go farther and faster and maybe break that mold, right? And be one of that 1% female leaders at the top of the house. And I know it's hard to look back and think about this, right? Because obviously you were courageous at 22. So you've got something inside you that maybe not everyone always pull out. But I'm really curious, like what do you think has made a difference for you, or what do you think will make a difference for somebody else who's listening and is 22 years old and does want to make it to the C-suite?
I think I've always tried to remember what's important to me. There have been some really dark times in my career where I have found myself in a job that not only didn't make me happy, but actually made me question my self-worth. And back to that originating story, I would have to call upon that courage and say, now's the time to cut my losses. I need to go find something better for me. I always knew that there was a place for me where I could feel valued, where I could be respected, and I could have impact. Being willing to be true to myself has helped me, I think, advance my career in ways that feel really satisfying, that I can look back upon with pride. I mean, even the disasters have a silver lining and experiences that I wouldn't give up because it's all been part of who I am today. But I think it's really important that grinding out is not necessarily a badge of honor. Sometimes that's really self-destructive, and HR people need to be better at self-care than we do. And so I would encourage people to remember what's important to you, because there are places that deserve that.
So well said. It's very inspirational, Angela. Thank you for all you do for so many people, to inspire them and to really give back. And I think just sharing your stories is huge. As you know, there's one final question that I ask every guest. What is that one word or phrase that you believe will define the future of HR over the next 5 to 10 years?
Human intelligence. Even as we continue to lean into AI, we can never forget that this is all still about people. And that's who we're here to serve.
I love it. Angela, thank you so much for being on the podcast and sharing your story. So much great wisdom today. I love the triangle. I think a lot of people really will take that home. So incredible conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you, JP.
As always, you can go to futureofhr.com to view all of our past episodes and learn more about our mission to inspire the next generation of HR leaders. If you enjoyed this episode, The Future of HR, be sure to subscribe or share our podcast with at least one other person. This really helps us to grow the podcast and helps with our mission of inspiring the next generation of HR leaders. We'll be back next week with Monica Rothgary. Monica is a sought-after keynote speaker, consultant, and author who's on a mission to help organizations unlock pent-up productivity and growth by empowering their frontline leaders. Monica started her career as a restaurant manager for Taco Bell, and 30 years later, she was the first woman chief operating officer of KFC US and Yum Brands. We're going to be going deep on Monica's new book, Lessons from the Drive-Thru, and why organizations must do more to invest in their frontline leaders. This is a great conversation and one you won't want to miss. Thanks again for listening to The Future of HR and being part of our community.